Allstate Skyline Studio.
WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everybody. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, live from the Allstate Skyline Studio. Wow, what an opening that was. That was a little bit of a shocker. Yeah, I guess it's about time we kind of change things up since we've been here since June, I believe, and the old tag for the show was still live from Tribune Tower. So, yes, we are indeed in the Allstate Skyline Studio at overlooking Wacker Drive and the Chicago River, and a cloudy morning over Navy Pier this morning. This is our weekly look at the world of politics and policy as we go from City Hall to the State House and on to the White House. So time to grab that Sunday paper, get that hot cup of coffee. You'll need it this morning. And we'll do our best to get your week off to a great start. And with that opening, I mean, I can't
think of
it. Did
that wake you up?
Yes, it sure did. Did you know it was coming?
I didn't. No. That took me by surprise, but it was sounded great.
Yes, it did. Yes, it did. I'm glad to kind of shake things up every now and then.
Well, that did.
Yeah, just in case I wasn't awake, I certainly am awake now, that's for sure. Kind of a chilly weekend, you know? Just not... we have our shortest day of the year. Is that coming up?
That's coming up. That will be around December 20th or 21st when it will be darker than it is now. I think let's see. It'll be around the Sunday we're on the air before Christmas, Rick.
Oh, so like
so
the 23rd.
We, you know, at this time in 2 weeks, we won't have any and there won't be much come 4:30 in the afternoon. But then right around Christmas, of course, 23rd, 24th, little bit more, you know, little by little, things get lighter and lighter and the days get a little bit longer.
Yeah, I don't
know.
Can't
come soon enough as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, just, I don't know if I've noticed it more this week, and maybe it's just because of the lack of sunshine that we've been having here in the city, but...
It's been very drab, hasn't it?
Yeah, and then, you know, then you get it becoming darker earlier, and it's just kind of, eh. You know?
That's a good way to describe it.
Well, I don't know why. That's why I'm a wordsmith, by the way. Yes. But it's been very hard to get motivated because of the just, I mean, they're like perfect days where you just almost want to just go back to bed.
Mm-hmm. I've been very close to doing that. I've been very close to doing that.
No, so. I don't believe that. You are one of the best self-starters I know. Dave.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Well, I must put on a pretty good act.
I was going to say, you're that, you talk a pretty good game.
I must put on a pretty good act.
No, I mean, you're always doing something. You're always out and about. I mean, traveling everywhere. You're picking up the Christmas ham on tomorrow.
Yeah, right. Yeah, there's plenty to do, you know, so especially this time of year. You know, you think you've got kind of a leg up on things, and you, oh no, wait, I've got to do this yet.
Oh, I've never been that way. I mean, this is like, today is when I kind of decided I better start Christmas shopping. I mean,
I'm half done.
Are you?
Mm-hmm.
See,
I'm half done.
Now, is that just talk, or you really are?
No, I really am. I'm not putting on an act.
Okay,
here.
Getting the Christmas ham does not count.
No,
okay.
No, it doesn't. Okay. No, but in terms of gifts and presents and cards and that sort of thing, I am half done.
Well, that's great. That's great.
So I need to keep on a roll this week because next week I will be tied up here almost every morning covering for Steve Grzanich and doing other things.
So you'll be doing the morning business?
I'll be doing morning anchoring.
Very good.
Yeah, I'll be on with Steve Cochran and whoever may be filling in for him as we get closer to Christmas and the week after Christmas. So we'll be here for that time. So I need to get almost everything done this week.
Are you ordering a lot, or are you actually
I've ordered
going?
Some. I've ordered some. But when it comes to Christmas, and the older I get, the more old-fashioned I become about it. I had a nice afternoon last week strolling through Macy's downtown.
Really?
The Christmas department, the Christmas section. And it just kind of made me feel good, you know, put me into the spirit of things. And
made you spend more money.
And made me spend more money, yeah, right. Likewise at the Chris Kindle market.
Oh, well, you can't help but spend money there. I mean, that's just... That's...
And people have. That's been very successful. I talked with Marin, who is the manager there, who I've known for a number of years. I said, how was the first weekend? And she just looked at me and said, we were packed. So best times of day to go, seriously, the best times of day to go there, if you can, is mid-afternoon, after lunch, during the week. It's the crowds are at their minimal point, and you'll have an easier time getting into seeing things and the most popular attractions. So other than that, you know, the weekends, of course, they'll just be packed. And the fact that we're going to have dry weather this weekend, even though it's cold, no precipitation.
Yeah, but that's part of the cold is part of...
The cold's part of it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, the cold is part of it. But, I mean, I'm just saying if it was rainy and sleety and snowy and slushy and out there, it might not be as pleasant.
You were talking about going through Macy's. I have to tell you, I've been having a difficult time going down Michigan Avenue here over to Wacker with going by the Blackhawk store this time of year. And thank goodness for Rocky Wirtz putting up the Hockey House, which is kind of a pop-up store with Winter Classic wear.
Yeah, I have to check this out now.
Yeah, they just debuted their practice jerseys.
I love it. Yeah. I definitely want it.
Yeah.
Which is great because it's got the
C with the tomahawks.
Yes, yeah. That is just so neat. Yeah. And I guess they're only selling the red is reserved for the players.
Yeah, I think they're only selling the black jersey
and the white one
and the white one. Yeah, yeah. And then the black jersey for the Winter Classic itself.
Right, 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 and. I mean,
I should say black sweater.
Black sweater. Excuse me.
Yes.
Yes. You know better than that. But I do like the black Winter Classic ski cap. That's the jersey. I'm still kind of.
Yeah, it's modeled after the 34 jersey.
Yeah, but the 34 jersey had color in it.
It did. This is absence of all color, basically. It's the black jersey with a kind of like a.
Black with white stripes.
Yeah, and it's like a hollowed out logo almost. It's almost like an X-ray.
Except now, I did take a look at one of them, and it's got the lettering and the numerals on it are like felt.
Ah, okay.
It's not just like, you know, a sewed on
silk screen, or there's just a sewed on. It's the
it's like a felt,
just like an old letter you would get in school, varsity letter,
right.
That kind of thing. That you'd sew onto a jacket.
It looks very nice. I hope that's the softest thing about the Blackhawks when they play that Winter Classic against the Bruins on New Year's. The woes continue.
It's unbelievable how these woes continue. I think I just said in sports, 9 straight games now allowing the first goal. And this is not a team that is really comfortable playing from behind, as we've noticed here in the last couple of days. But they did actually get a lead in the game the other night, which was cause for a little celebration.
As long as you didn't have to watch the third period.
Yeah, unless you didn't want to watch the next minute.
Right.
Because in the feature to the next minute were 2 goals in 12 seconds.
Yeah. I mean, I keep looking for signs of optimism, and they're getting fewer and fewer to find. The worst power play in the league.
Yeah.
Almost, if not the worst... penalty defense.
Yeah, and I believe now they have the worst goal differential in the league as well.
Yeah, and it is. It just pains me these first period goals, because you know they've dug the hole already.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure, and because it's only human nature to be saying, okay, here we go again. You know, I mean,
yeah.
even the most skilled player in the. The most veteran of player probably is thinking that inside his head, thinking, oh, man, again?
Right, Right.
Here, and it kind of takes you off your game.
Here we go again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What do we think about tonight? Bears, Rams?
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting. You know, there's a lot of talk about whether or not the Rams will be able to compete in the chilly weather of Chicago. I tend to overlook those kind of things because not everybody was born and raised in Los Angeles.
Right.
There are some folks that were probably born in other areas that where it's a little cold and a little chilly. And that's what they were used to playing in college or in high school. So I don't put a whole lot of credence into that. But I'm going to try to put the credence into the baseball adage of good pitching will stop good hitting.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to go with good defense will stop good offense. And I think that the Bears defense is going to be pinning its ears back and getting ready to introduce Jared Goff to the Soldier Field turf, or if it's painted dirt by now. Hopefully he'll be having a nice comfortable seat down there.
Well, I mean, this is a top matchup in the NFL.
I mean, the Rams are 11-1, best record in football. They've got not just an offense, but they also have a very good defense. Aaron Donald, who many think might even eclipse Khalil Mack as the defensive player of the year. Mack was the when he signed the contract with the Bears, eclipsed that of Aaron Donald, who had the richest contract in NFL history as far as the defender went, and then along came Khalil Mack at his $90 million. But I really think that it's going to depend on, and I've said this a couple of times in the last couple of weeks, run the football.
Yeah.
Run the football.
Let's rest Mitch's shoulder a
little bit. Not even just that. It's just give the defense something else to think about.
Right.
I mean, Tariq Cohen is unbelievable. What he did in that game against the Giants was nothing short of spectacular. Running, catching, and throwing for touchdowns in that game. But you know, you've got this guy named Jordan Howard who's a pretty good little runner who's set Bears records with 1,000-yard seasons in his first two. No other running back had ever done that in Bears history.
Well, all eyes are going to be glued on this game.
Yes, I agree.
This has to probably be one of the highest-rated Sunday night games
season. Whenever the Bears are involved, it usually is.
Yeah, yes. Well, Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news. And he, of course, has the... Yeah, that's Dave. We've got Andy with all the sports. Producer Cassara's got your phone calls at 312-981-7200. That's also our text line, 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. And we're on Twitter at @SundaySpin. And engineer Bob is here when he's not looking for all the wrapping paper. Remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNradio.com. You can also get our podcast at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to The Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson from the Chicago Tribune. Lots of news on the national front. We have, as Dave's been reporting, the president announcing that John Kelly will be leaving as President Trump's chief of staff at the end of the year. A lot of reports of discord going on, including the fact that, according to some reports, the two of them aren't even talking to each other. Kelly had been long rumored to be leaving the post, and so the president says that he will be leaving at the end of the year, and we'll see who the president picks. Someone, of course, that he will demand great loyalty from, which was one of the issues involved. We already had former Secretary of State Rex Tillerson last week saying that he spent plenty of time advising the president that certain courses of action that the president was recommending were in violation of the law. We also had the filing by Special Counsel Robert Mueller, as well as from the Southern District of New York, involving various issues surrounding Michael Cohen, the investigation into Russia. Now, what we have is that from Robert Mueller and the New York prosecutors that Trump continued to secretly seek to do business in Russia deep into the presidential campaign, even as Russian agents made efforts to influence him. At the same time, according to prosecutors, Trump ordered hush payments to two women to suppress stories of impropriety in violation of campaign finance laws. The investigation shows no sign of stopping. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio. And joining me on the phone is the gold standard of pollsters, J.N. Selzer. And thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Well, good morning, Chicago, from here in Des Moines.
What's the weather in Des Moines this morning?
Chilly.
Yeah, but you didn't get socked with that snow that's hitting down south.
We have missed every snowstorm that we prepared for. So,
well, because it's not a caucus year. That's why. I remember when the gates went up closing I-35. Trust me. I know those days. Well, yes. Ann, thanks so much for joining me. And I'm glad you could join me because I really appreciate the fact that you're doing this work in conjunction with Grinnell College on national polling and really kind of it fills a gap right now where I think people have questions about, you know, who we are, the politics that we support. Obviously, we'd have the big, you know, results of the midterm election. But what I was curious about in this latest poll, and this is the second poll, I believe, that you've done with Grinnell
That's
College.
Right.
We've seen from September to, I guess, the end of November, November 24th through 27th was when the polling was done, a slight uptick in the job approval for Donald Trump, despite what we saw in the midterms as far as House races across the country.
You know, it's interesting, and let me just begin by saying one of the guiding lights of the Grinnell College National Poll, their motto at the college is to ask hard questions and question easy answers. So the poll gives plenty of chances to do that. We did see an uptick in the approval rating. It went from 39% to up to 43%, and that was really a legitimate uptick. I mean, the disapproval rate went down. That doesn't always happen. Sometimes it's just people making up their minds about it. And the president's favorability number went up as well. What was really striking to us was we asked a question about the intent to reelect.
Right.
President, and give them three choices. Would you definitely vote to reelect if the election were held today? Consider someone else, or definitely vote for someone else. And that number was relatively unchanged. And we dug into the data and found that the reason there is that Republicans were less likely in November than they had been in September to say they would definitely vote to reelect the president.
So some softening among the core Republican.
Some softening among the core. So, of course, we wanted to dig into that and say what's going on. And, you know, our rule of thumb for an incumbent is they're really looking for half.
50%, right.
To say that they will vote to reelect. I mean, they're sitting president. You know what you need to know to decide to be there. And so many of the constituencies that had been the Trump base, if you will, there was only one of them that crossed that 50% line. It wasn't white men with less than a college education. It was rural voters. And then it was just 51%. So even if you don't get to 50% overall, you should have some constituencies where a majority say they would definitely vote to reelect.
Yeah, and we should point out that on the question of definitely vote to reelect, in September that was 30%, and in November was 32%. So basically an unchanged, despite that uptick in job approval. And yeah, 50% is what an incumbent wants. And I have to wonder if when you find that 51% among rural voters, if that isn't just kind of an extension of what we kind of saw in the midterms of kind of a rural-urban-slash-suburban divide in this country.
You know, one of the things I found the most fascinating in this poll was that, indeed, people think of that cleavage as being between the urban, suburban, sort of urban-y, sort of suburbs, and then the rural. But really, when we broke where you live out four ways, you could say, I live in a city, I live in a suburb, I live in a town, or I live in a rural area. And three of those geographies acted very similarly, and that was rural, town, and I'm sorry, that was city, suburb, and town. Rural was the one that was the most different. So that isn't just a city-suburb phenomenon in our poll. And I think the thing, again, that we just found the most interesting is that this is not just affecting perceptions of the president, which it is, but it is most strongly affecting perceptions of the Republican Party overall. 58% of rural voters say they have favorable feelings. That number is just 37% among people who live in towns, and that's lower, modestly so, than people who live in suburbs or cities. So, yes, an extension of what we saw happening in the midterms, but potentially an even greater divide.
And that raises all kinds of questions. I mean, you know, here locally in Chicago, obviously urban city, traditionally Democratic, but in the midterms, the suburbs, the collar counties, as they're known here, which were always kind of the traditional Republican firewall to the Democratic votes outside the city. And of those collar counties, five of the six went for a Democrat for governor. Two hotly contested congressional seats flipped from Republican to Democrat. And there were two downstate seats, areas that were more rural. They were contested, but they were held by the Republicans. And so, I mean, we kind of are living with that kind of divide. Although, as you point out, with towns downstate, a number of counties went Democratic for governor for the first time in decades. So I can kind of see how fleshing that out. There is that differentiation of people that consider themselves rural, even to what you might consider as somebody who lives in a town.
And I think what that means is if you go back and look at that 2016 map and you see just kind of this sea of red across the parts of the country that are dominated by vast areas of rural, that isn't necessarily locked in, that there's potential, and we saw that begin to play out in the midterms, there's potential for a lot more realignment out there come 2020.
We're speaking with J. Ann Selzer, president of Selzer & Company, the great pollster from Des Moines, Iowa. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Joining me on the phone is J. Ann Selzer, president of Selzer & Company, noted pollster from Des Moines, Iowa. We're talking about the results of the latest National Grinnell College poll conducted at the end of November. And we've been talking about the president's job approval rating as well as reelect numbers. And Ann, just one more question along those lines. What I thought was very interesting, and maybe this accounts for that uptick a little bit, is when people were asked about kind of about their personal finances and whether they were moving closer or further away from their hopes when it comes to their own finances, 64% moving closer, 26% moving further away. I mean, that to me shows a great deal of optimism in the economy.
That's right. This is, you can imagine, a time when those numbers might well have been reversed. That is, you know, in the not so distant past, when we were in the midst of the Great Recession, that people were very fearful about their economic future. And if you were to say, tell me about your financial dreams, they would have, well, if there was laughter, it would have been cynical laughter. So when we have a number that is more than twice, people feel that they're moving closer to their financial dreams than moving farther away. And a lot of that farther away, those might be dominated by seniors who aren't still in the midst midst of their career building time in their life, you know, those are very strong numbers. And you just look around at the environment. At the time we were taking this, the stock market was still in good health. The job market, certainly, since Donald Trump has taken office, the unemployment rate has consistently fallen. We're, Iowa is at an all-time low. I don't know how things are in Illinois, but we hear good things. So remarkable that you wouldn't sort of use that as the number one reason to say, more of the same, please. Let's have more of this.
Right, right, right. It's just, as I said, very fascinating things. Another thing, too, is obviously we have a president who very strongly continues to campaign on build the wall issues of trying to limit immigrants in this country. And yet the poll findings found, particularly like the question about refugees, and of course there was all of the talk of the quote caravan and those kinds of things, and you know, these questions about do we have a moral responsibility to, you know, care yeah. about people, I mean, very favorable about immigration.
You know, this is something that is of particular interest to some of the faculty members at Grinnell, and we're fortunate that we have input into our questions from faculty and students there. And we took a kind of stepped into perceptions of immigration in our September poll and really dug a little bit deeper here. Yes, we had the sort of situation at the Southern Wall. We said, you know, wanted to know if people felt that the U.S. had an obligation, and in fact, a majority said that the U.S. does. But we also dug further into that and said, okay, well, here's some areas of the world, and do you think the U.S. law should make it so that there's an increase, a decrease, or keep it about the same? And I think one of the things that is just so striking is that regardless of the region of the world that we asked about, the dominant response was people saying you could keep that about the same or perhaps increase. This is not, we conclude, an anti-immigrant nation. You know, the largest percentage where people say they would like to see immigration decrease was from the Middle East. It's 27%. It's 1 in 4. It's balanced, not quite, by 17% saying it should increase, but 49%, almost half, say leave it the same. And, of course, people are interested in Mexico, equal numbers virtually saying it should increase as say it should decrease. And again, almost half saying it should stay the same. There's just not a huge proportion that are wishing to restrict, as we see it, immigration into this country.
No, indeed, from anywhere on this list, about the same, the minimum is 49%. I mean, that's half right there. That just leave things alone.
That's right. And if you add the increase
right.
to it, increase or leave the same, you're getting close to 2 out of 3.
Well, indeed, for the Middle East, where 27% say decrease, you add 49% about the same and 17% increase. I mean, that's well over 3/4. So we're 2/3 there.
The numbers from Canada were not much different than
correct.
The numbers from Mexico. So,
which I'm not sure what that says, but...
It just says that if you look at the news, you would think that there is this... hate is a strong word. It's something we took a look at
right.
in some other questions. But there is just a strong... We have too many immigrants in this country, and we need to stop letting them in. And we find no support that is a dominant opinion in this country.
Well, and coupled with that, I enjoyed another question, which was the question about what it means to be a real American and mentioning certain traits that are associated with Americans. And when you look at the very important category, how people... you know, view things as very important, and among the highest are accepting people of different religious backgrounds, of different racial backgrounds, to 90% to believe in treating people equally as an American trait. And we're talking about all people.
That's right. And one of the reasons, again, this comes out of a couple of professors, their research interests about there are a group of people who sort of define being an American. Hey, you know what? You need to have been born here. You need to speak the language. You need to be a Christian. You need to have certain innate qualities. And what our poll really found is that those test much lower, and what tests really high are certain key values. And what really struck me is the top two, one at 90% and one at 88%. One, you know, just by conventional wisdom, would align more with the Republican way of thinking, to take personal responsibility for one's actions. 88% say that that's very important to being a real American. And the 90% was for to believe in treating people equally. That kind of aligns with the Democratic side. Well, we found very little partisan difference, and just by algebra, you couldn't have much partisan difference
right.
to get that overall high number. So, you know, when people, again, this is one of the reasons that we conduct the poll the way that we do, that we set ourselves in a position to find common ground. And here's ways of starting conversations with people that almost everyone will agree with, that you can start a conversation with, you know, I think it's really important to treat people equally, or I think it's really important to take personal responsibilities for actions. And then you can begin a political conversation that might lead to some differences, but you've started in a place where whoever you're talking to is most likely to agree with you.
And common ground is one of the things everybody is looking for these days. And before you go, I wanted to ask you, how has polling become more difficult these days as far as getting survey, getting actually, you know, being able to get a hold of people and with cell phones and those kinds of things? Is polling a much harder operation to do these days?
Well, I used to say every election cycle, it gets more different. And then I started saying, well, every year. And now I pretty much say every nanosecond, it gets more difficult. But, you know, there are some things that have come along the way that actually have helped us. You know, we have a decent national reputation, and so when we say we're calling from Selzer & Company, there are people who will stay with us. We don't use robo-calling, so we're not annoying in that way. We have live operators on the air. And we're finding really no downtick in response rates over the last several years. So it took a plunge. There's no doubt about it. But the work that the Pew Center has done says that response rate is less predictive of quality. So as long as I'm able to be as accurate as I'm able to be, and for now, that's still looking pretty good. It's a little bit hard for me to sit here and say that polling is too difficult to do when we can still be accurate in forecasting elections.
And I will tell you, folks, as I said, Ann Selzer is the gold standard. There is no doubt about it. From the Iowa polls with the Des Moines Register, and I see now that CNN is partnering on with those.
That's right. That's right. That's a new partnership. They're going to, they bring a couple of things to the table. They bring a very good polling operation, and so we'll have a partner in thinking about things from some different perspectives. And of course, they bring, there is no more expensive polling that can be done than trying to find caucus goers.
Yes.
So they bring some financial resources as well.
Very good. Looking forward to seeing the results of that as well as the next Grinnell College poll. Ann Selzer, president of Selzer & Company, Des Moines, Iowa-based company, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
This has been my pleasure.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Yesterday, the New York Times reported that the president's son-in-law and senior advisor, Jared Kushner, was continuing to have private conversations with the crown prince in Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, despite the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. He is the late columnist for the Washington Post. Kushner offered the de facto Saudi ruler advice, quote, about how to weather the storm, unquote, following Khashoggi's death. That comes as last week the CIA briefed members of the Senate Intelligence Committee on findings that the Crown Prince, MBS as he's known, was complicit in Khashoggi's death in October. Consternation coming from leading Republican senators. Here's South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham.
Saudi Arabia is a strategic ally, and the relationship is worth saving, but not at all cost. We'll do more damage to our standing in the world and our national security by ignoring MBS than dealing with him. MBS, the Crown Prince, is a wrecking ball. I think he's complicit in the murder of Mr. Khashoggi to the highest level possible. I think the behavior before the Khashoggi murder was beyond disturbing, and I cannot see him being a reliable partner to the United States. Saudi Arabia and MBS are two different entities. If the Saudi government is going to be in the hands of this man for a long time to come, I find it very difficult to be able to do business, because I think he's crazy. I think he is dangerous, and he has put the relationship at risk.
That's Lindsey Graham. And then there's Bob Corker, the Tennessee Republican who chairs the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
I have zero question in my mind that the Crown Prince, MBS, ordered the killing, monitored the killing, knew exactly what was happening, planned it in advance. If he was in front of a jury, he would be convicted in 30 minutes, guilty. So the question is, what do we do about that?
And a valid question, because we have President Trump basically saying kid gloves treatment to the Saudi government and MBS because the relationship is too valuable, more valuable than the death of a journalist. Well, we're going to switch gears here now, and we're going to speak with Rob Carr. Rob is the president and CEO of the Illinois Retail Manufacturers Association. Rob, good morning.
Morning, Rick. Retail merchants.
Oh, you know what? I got confused because of seeing you at the Greg Bays event.
I know.
Greg Bays retiring after 27 years as the head of the Illinois Manufacturers Association. Rob, of course, with the Retail Merchants Association. And Rob, I wanted to have you on because I know that during the campaign for governor, J.B. Pritzker was very supportive of a $15 an hour minimum wage and has indicated that he sees that as something that he'd like to accomplish early in a first term. But it's uncertain how he wants to accomplish it. Most people think that it would be kind of a phased-in increase. Does that assuage any opposition to you by your organization?
No, it really doesn't. I think there's comfort in the fact that Governor-elect Pritzker has approached us and others with the idea of having conversations and getting input. We clearly understand what he wants to do. I think, though, that there needs to be significant discussion around what's good, for example, in the city of Chicago may not have the same impact in the suburbs, which may not have the same impact downstate. As you know, Rick, Illinois is a large state, diverse state, not just geographically, but economically. And it does not take away our opposition. Obviously, anything would have to be phased in. You can't just jump from 13 to 15 or from 825 to 15. But I think there's other considerations that have to go into play as well.
So, I mean, is it possible to do like a regional variation?
Well, I think that's something that has to be discussed. There was a recent study put out by one of the usual suspects when it comes to pro $15 wage increase advocates, saying that it could be done without any impact. But the researcher for the city of Seattle, who was also pro 15, noted that their data took assumed economic stats for Chicago and applied them downstate, which you and I both know can't and shouldn't be done. So we have to look at things like that. We might have to look at business sizes. There's a number of variations, I think, that have to be looked at if indeed the state's going to go down this road.
As well as, I mean, when we talk about minimum wage, too, about different categories like restaurant workers who get tips, those kinds of things that exist in current law, right?
Right. You have the tip credit. And then I think you also have to look at who's the target. Who is government trying to benefit here? Do we really want to incent teenagers or even younger adults who should be incented to be pursuing either a trade or a trade education or higher education? Do we really want to incent them to not pursue that? You know, at $15, had I been paid $15 or you'd been paid $15 when you were teenagers, that seems like an awful lot of money when you're that young. And it could have perverse impacts. So we really need to proceed slowly here and take a hard look at what we're really trying to do, again, if the state wants to pursue this, because it will have negative impacts.
With the low unemployment, isn't there the argument that the marketplace would kind of drive wages up?
I think we're seeing that. That's the argument we have long made, that the marketplace will drive it up, and we are seeing this strong labor market that has had that effect. We have seen national employers who have voluntarily committed to raising their wages to 13 or 15 nationwide over a period of time. What's important about that, though, is it's not a one-size-fits-all. It is a company making a decision based on its financials and what it's willing to do. But what is interesting is, as you, I'm sure, have witnessed as well, some of those companies then followed up with cuts to other benefits or to hours or to headcount to help afford those increases. So again, everything has a cause and a reaction. Nothing just happens by itself in a vacuum.
It's not nothing static when it comes.
Nothing static. Yeah, that's exactly right. Nothing static. And I think the strong job market helps. But you and I both know that what goes up will come down. And when the next recession comes, it's never an if, it's always a when. The next recession comes, and depending how deep it is, that higher wage also then forces deeper cuts to help people weather the help companies weather the recession. So we have to be wary of that as well.
We're speaking with Rob Carr. He's the president and CEO of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio. And joining me on the phone is Rob Carr, president and CEO of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association. We're talking about the issue of the incoming Pritzker administration wanting to increase the minimum wage. And Rob, I guess, you know, everybody's kind of wondering as we go into this new world order in Springfield, a new governor, someone who is holding his first elected office. We've got expanded Democratic majorities in the Illinois House and Senate. But as far as with Pritzker, he's a successful businessman. Do you get a sense that this is somebody that the merchants, the manufacturers, that this is somebody they can work with?
Yeah, Rick, we made the decision, as you'll recall, Irma decided not to endorse in the gubernatorial
right.
election. We are of the belief, based on several interviews with the governor-elect himself, that while we disagree on issues, he is going to take an inclusive approach to decision-making, that he's going to try to bring everybody together. I think that's something that most people will agree has been missing in Springfield for several years. He'll have his work cut out for him, because not only will he have entities that don't normally align perhaps with his views, but he's going to have members of his own party who are taking already a no-compromise, our-way-or-the-highway approach. But I think you'll recall, we've been around long enough, Rick, that we recall that Illinois has really only worked well when everyone works together in bipartisan solutions to the problems. It's never really worked well. Illinois has never really prospered with a my way or a highway approach. So we are confident in the early stages here that he's going to take that approach. And, you know, only time will tell.
There's a part of me that kind of longs for the days of the agreed bill process.
You and me both. As you know, we still have that for unemployment insurance. And that has continued to work well. But, there sure needs to be a whole lot more effort at agreement.
Well, let me explain. So that's where you would get all of the people at the table. And basically, you don't come out of the room until you guys got a deal. And
that's exactly right. And you know, we have the AFL-CIO is the point person for the labor side of the table. I'm the point person for the employer side of the table. We have representatives from each side, and we sit around the table and discuss the issues and come to an agreement. And that sends to all the policymakers the message of, listen, this is what everyone agrees to. This moves the unemployment insurance process forward, and it spares the policymakers, whether it's legislators or the governor, from having to choose between friends or make bad decisions. It also keeps the system stable. We don't have the wild swings we used to have, where one side's friends are in control and make favorable decisions, and the next cycle somebody else's friends are in control. And so it's served the system well over decades.
It's kind of like how it's the House Labor Committee when Democrats control things and the House Commerce Committee when Republicans control the chamber.
Right.
All in a name, right?
Right.
Rob, tell me, what's the attitude of retailers in this holiday season? Are they sensing optimism? I mean, we had Ann Selzer on earlier saying nationally that there's a kind of an economic optimism among the public. Is that being reflected in holiday shopping?
Well, there's certainly optimism in the retail community. Now, you know, you always have to point out retailers tend to be among the most optimistic all the time anyway. Even
I always think of you as the biggest optimist in the world.
they tend to take that view. And so, but they are clearly optimistic about this season. I know the National Retail Federation, their predictions, we're looking at something in the neighborhood of 4.8% increase when all is said and done. Over last year, which would be a very large increase. But let's say they're off. Let's say it's only 4%. That would still be a large increase. We're seeing good traffic. We saw good traffic over the Thanksgiving, Black Friday, Small Business Saturday, Cyber Monday time period. And we continue to see good traffic. So, yes, they're optimistic, Rick, as we head into these, go through these holiday seasons, that things will turn out well.
Yeah, 4% to 5% growth. That's some real numbers there.
That's some real numbers. And what's interesting is, you know, online growth continues to online sales continue to explode and do very well. But omnichannel is really raising eyebrows. Omnichannel is someone who's offering both brick and mortar, social media, online. That is where the action is really catching traction this holiday season. And I think it reflects the evolution of the industry as you see online getting into brick and mortar and brick and mortar developing their online and capabilities, which just serves to benefit the consumer.
That's Rob Carr. He's president and CEO of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association. Rob, as always, thanks for joining the show.
Oh, Rick, my pleasure. Always good to be with you. Have a great Sunday.
And have a great holiday.
Now, the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Washington Post had a panel last week featuring U.S. Senators Dick Durbin and Chuck Grassley, Republican from Iowa, talking about the inability of Mitch McConnell to call legislation to basically what's being called criminal justice reform by both sides, and the fact that even the president supports it, but Mitch McConnell won't call it. And during this interview, this panel, Grassley actually offered some advice for Donald Trump.
Hey, listen, the president could solve all of his problems if he just showed the his wife the tweet before he punches the send button.
That's Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley. Also today, today's a day for history buffs. This is the 10th anniversary of the arrest of Rod Blagojevich.
A day that will live in infamy in Illinois politics.
Well, a day that everybody certainly who was involved remembers, and I certainly remember it well, and I remember the Tribune putting out a extra edition that day. But what I remember, too, is that just the night before at Tribune Tower, Blagojevich was doing an interview with CNN, and which was located on the same floor as the radio station there in Tribune Tower. And I was interviewing him because we knew that he was being investigated for allegations of selling the U.S. Senate seat of then-President-elect Barack Obama. And I was up interviewing him to ask him about how he was brokering this deal. And this is what Blagojevich had to say.
You know, it's an important decision. It's a deliberate process. There are a lot of moving parts in this. There are some real opportunities, potentially, to get results for people. I'm just not going to rush it because maybe...
it's a big deal.
I think it's a big deal.
Okay.
Well, how about this? I mean, this would be the great... Among the great ironies would be if you got laid off because the Tribune failed as a business, the paper, and I made you a senator. Wouldn't that be something?
So, yes, I was the last person offered the Senate seat before Rod Blagojevich was arrested.
That's close.
Yeah. Let's just say I was biting my tongue very hard because I knew he was getting arrested the next day, and obviously he didn't. So, yeah, that quite a memory there. Well, that other voice you're hearing is my good friend and colleague Bill Ruthart, a member of the political team specializing in covering the mayor's race and the mayor for the Chicago Tribune. Bill, thanks so much for joining me this morning.
Good to be on.
So... Last Sunday, in talking about the mayor's race, Monday was the day for petition challenges to be filed. And at that time, I kind of expected everybody's going to get challenged. You had 21 people that filed, whatever. But some people got off without being challenged. It was interesting that Tony Preckwinkle decided to challenge Susana Mendoza and a few others. And, you know, because everybody, I think, was starting to shape this race as those are kind of the top two in this vast field of candidates.
Right. So to kind of paint the picture for you, you need 12,500 signatures from registered Chicago voters to get in the ballot in Chicago. And the practice is to turn in far more signatures than that because... Some can be flawed. Some, you know, if you're paying people to circulate petitions, sometimes those people, you know, fill out the signatures themselves to get paid, that kind of thing. So
that's why Lazy Susan sales go up for the round tabling.
So the rule of thumb is you're bulletproof if you turn in three times the 12,500 signatures. And so when Susana Mendoza turned in 25,000, a lot of eyebrows were raised because, you know, you'd expect more signatures than that, especially from a statewide
politician,
state comptroller, right? So, although on the flip side, she had to pivot quickly to the mayoral race and, you know, so maybe didn't have as much time to collect signatures as some other campaigns, or at least wasn't actively overseeing it in the way that other candidates were. And so, yes, Preckwinkle, challenged Mendoza. There were, you know, a page or two leaking out here and there on Twitter that, you know, it was 10 or 12 signatures on the same handwriting. Of course, if you could probably pull a page from just about any candidate's petitions and find a page or two that looks like that. So it's not necessarily a representative sample, but clearly Preckwinkle's folks are projecting confidence that they think they can get Mendoza kicked off the ballot. They challenged some 14,000 of the 25,000 signatures, which would knock her below the threshold. Now, they'd have to have a pretty high success rate in getting all those signatures tossed out.
Yeah, I mean, that's the counter to this, right, is that they would have to have a very high bar.
Right, and I think that's what Mendoza's people are saying. They're confident that she'll remain on the ballot. I mean, one really interesting part is about 900 of those signatures are the Preckwinkle campaign is alleging that someone signed Mendoza's petition after they signed somebody else's. And the law is you can only sign one petition per candidate per office.
So the first one you sign would be the only good one.
Right.
Except
we don't know when people sign the petitions because they don't date the signature. The only date that's on the petitions is the date when they're notarized. And so this could be, you know, if we get down to, you know, a few dozen signatures and that's what they're arguing over, we could very well see this end up in court.
There's no time stamp on a signature.
Right. So it's going to be interesting to see whether that's an issue that other candidates point to on petitions. Some of these candidates who got in late, Bill Daley is another one who's being challenged by Jerry Joyce. If you have duplicate signatures, if nothing else, it could tie you up for a while in making legal arguments. So,
well, and certainly, you know, they can go to these voters and ask them to testify.
Right. Sign an affidavit.
I signed it.
Yeah. Whatever. So, yeah.
I signed that one first, not this one, and that kind of.
Right. This is going to play out for the next month or so. You know, we have 21 candidates. There were, I'd say, 16 kind of declared known commodity candidates, and there were another 5 who filed on the day of.
Got their name.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think the over-under at City Hall is 10. We're going to see about 10 candidates actually make the ballot. I think it could be a little more than that, just depending on how this all shakes out. There's certainly some folks who are in danger of being kicked off the ballot. Activist Jamal Green is one. I'm not sure he turned in enough signatures or just barely enough. Tech entrepreneur Neil Salas Griffin turned in about 18,000, so he only has about a 6,000 margin. But he says him and his family collected most of them, so he has high confidence in the quality of the signatures. So we'll just have to wait and see how it all shakes out.
And this can be a lengthy process.
It can go. You know, technically the ballot's supposed to be certified December 21st, but you know, the Board of Elections officials are already saying this is going to carry into January, likely.
And they've already said that early voting isn't going to start when it's supposed to start.
Right, because the ballots won't be finalized yet. So, really, by the time the ballots are finalized, let's say it's sometime in early to mid-January, you know, we're only a month out from the February 26th election at that point. So, we're going to see this race ramp up quickly, especially as soon as the holidays are over, when campaigns start to feel like people are going to maybe start paying even closer attention.
That's what makes this weird, yeah, too, is because it's an election that, you know, let's face it, it really began before we even got through the November 6th state election.
Right.
And now you've got this kind of holiday period, which is traditionally kind of candidates, for the most part, you know, go silent.
Right.
People don't want to be bothered during the holidays. Not that there haven't been plenty of candidate forums and those kinds of things, but it's very difficult to campaign during the holiday season.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, and really even the forums haven't really kicked. There's been a few here and there, but I think we're going to see that accelerate as well. So, we haven't seen anybody raise big dollars in this race either. Rahm Emanuel had $10 million in the bank before he decided in September to drop his bid for a third term. You know, the highest so far in the race is Bill Daley's raised about $2.5 million, which is a decent amount of money. But when you start talking about what it costs to run, you know, broadcast television ads in Chicago, you can burn through that kind of money pretty quickly.
Well, and I think people were using the number of, like, as a baseline of $5 million. to really run the type of campaign you need to run.
At least through February, and then, you know, the top two candidates, if no one gets over 50% of the vote, which is extremely likely, the top two candidates go into an April 2nd runoff, a head-on-head race, then you start seeing a lot more money pour in because you have a much more clear decision, and the unions and some corporate interests that maybe are on the sidelines until they figure out what the choice is. It's a either or choice versus you know, one of seven or eight people choice. So
don't want to pick the losing horse.
That's right. You don't want to pick the losing horse too early. That's right. And I think a lot of people are waiting to see what kind of campaigns these candidates are going to run and how viable they are.
We're speaking with Bill Ruthart. He's a member of the political team, my colleague at the Chicago Tribune. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio. Joining me here in studio is my good friend and colleague Bill Ruthart, a member of the political team at the Chicago Tribune. We're talking about the race for mayor, and we've been talking about the objections that were filed by some of the candidates, but we also saw this past week the first kind of significant TV by a candidate with Bill Daley's ads that are up on the air now, which I also thought was kind of interesting. One, it's kind of a show of bravado to be the first one up and do it in a pretty major way. But also, again, it's holiday time. Is it getting any registration among the voters?
He's on the air through, I think, December 19th. So we'll see if he takes a pause and then gets back on the air, if he just stays on the air. But to me, the ad's also interesting for Bill Daley doesn't speak in the ad. It's this kind of slick edited, the final punchline of the ad is no more excuses, which you could take as kind of a shot at the current holder of the office. But there's no mention of, you know, the fact that his brother and father ran City Hall for 43 years. There's no kind of allusion to the previous Daley reign in Chicago. It's basically, here's this guy, Bill Daley, who's going to freeze your property taxes and get gangs and guns off the street. No more excuses. So, it's interesting. I mean, he's the first one to make kind of a significant network buy. Willie Wilson's had some ads here and there, but, Daley was up during the Army-Navy game yesterday and did a pretty good-sized cable buy, too, airing on CNN, MSNBC, and ESPN. So, I think he's trying to flex his muscles a little bit here as the candidate that's got some resources, albeit smaller than we're used to seeing when Rahm Emanuel's in the race.
But I have to wonder, too. I mean, everybody knows he's a Daley. You know, so you don't necessarily need the bio kind of
correct thing. Yeah,
but he is perhaps, you know, a lesser known Daley. He's known in certain circles. You know, we know him from being commerce secretary and from chief of staff, those kinds of things, but I don't know that the common person knows Bill Daley.
I think that's true, and I think it'll be interesting to see how much Daley does or doesn't refer to that resume while he's running, right? You know, I mean, in some ways, White House Chief of Staff to Barack Obama is something worth telling voters about.
So he can say, I'm like the guy who's got the office now.
Well,
I mean, it could play both ways.
It helped Rahm the first time.
Sure.
And then, as he got less popular with African-American voters, it meant less to them that he had the seal of approval from Barack Obama. So I think, it'll be interesting to see how much Daley, part of running for mayor of Chicago, especially when you get down to a runoff, if he makes a runoff, is can people trust you to run the city? And I think part of the Daley argument that people can trust him is he's got experience. He was an executive of J.P. Morgan Chase. He was U.S. Commerce Secretary under Bill Clinton. He was White House Chief of Staff under Obama for a year. And so I think he's going to have to make some of that argument, but just how far he goes and whether he gets into, he knows how the city's run because his family has done it, you know, it'll be interesting to see.
But at the same time, he tries to, I mean, he was upset at Emanuel for criticizing Rich, his brother.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, he wants people to say, look at me, I'm the Daily that's looking forward, don't look back.
Yeah, he's done some interesting things to try to distance himself from previous practices at City Hall. Like, one of the first things he did is come out for term limits for the mayor, which is, you know, when your family had it for four decades as mayor, that's an interesting way of trying to distance yourself from that. So, yeah, I mean, he's done some things that are trying to distance himself from the family. He famously told Emanuel to put his big boy pants on and quit criticizing his brother's, you know, financial stewardship of the city, because the mayor, Emanuel, been in for 8 years. Of course, the big joke at City Hall is the mayor will go on and on about the financial mess he inherited. He just will never say Rich Daley by name.
Right. Exactly. We also had some significant endorsements this week for Tony Preckwinkle.
Yes, Tony Preckwinkle, the Cook County Board president, a former teacher, got the endorsement of the Chicago Teachers Union, which was pretty influential in the mayor's race 4 years ago when they backed Jesus Chuy Garcia, who forced Emanuel to a runoff. CTU came in for some pretty big money for Garcia, and the National American Federation of Teachers also, you know, spent heavily for Chuy. So this is a good pickup for Preckwinkle. There's some whispers as to how much financial support the CTU might be able to provide this time around, but there's no dispute, especially after the teacher strike in Emanuel's first term, that this is a organized union. They are visible. They always have an agenda and a top two or three priorities that they want to see. And so I think that that was a you know, proud moment for Preckwinkle. You could clearly see she was beaming at the news conference there. And then she also got the support of SEIU Healthcare Illinois, and when one of the SEIU locals, she already had the endorsement of SEIU Local 1. That was also the other real big spender for Chuy Garcia 4 years ago. And so they're significant endorsements just because they're major unions. I think what does it mean to the race is how much money do they spend for her.
And how do they play in the field operation?
Right. How do they play in the field operation? But I think this race, it's so crowded. The way you're going to, you know, break out is to get on TV and to start getting in people's, you know, lives quickly.
Heads.
Right. Heads, however you want to say
their
it.
Eyes. So, yes.
And so I think, we'll have to see how much those unions kick in and how fast. I mean, Preckwinkle, for being the Cook County Democratic Party chairwoman, she only has $500,000 or so, and she's been in the race basically since Labor Day. So that is not a very, you know, robust campaign war chest by any stretch. And so it will be interesting to see how soon the money comes in from these unions and how much it is.
That's stuff we'll be watching. You'll definitely be watching. I'll be assisting you. I'll be your quote boy. How about that? It's Bill Ruthart from the political team at the Chicago Tribune, my colleague. Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Always a pleasure.